first female member of the Cape Winemakers Guild, historical matriarch of Warwick Wine Estate, doyen of the South African wine industry, I visit Norma Ratcliffe at her home in Claremont. In samenwerking met Wineland Media, deel van die Winpro familie.
I'd like to write a story about Warwick.
Yes.
But I need to think of someone who would help me, because okay. I'm not a writer, huh?
Yeah.
It's all up here, because my grandchildren are always saying, what did you do? Yeah. What did you used to do?
Oh, right.
You know, I've told them lots of stories.
Yes.
And they said, but why don't you put it down on paper? So I put a few things down.
Yeah.
But I thought,
just to document.
Yeah, but I'd like to make it into a book for my family.
Yes, yeah. But that is the point of this discussion as well, Norma. And thank you for inviting me. The house is gorgeous, by the way. I love the art. The sketches in the bathroom is just, it's beautiful. It must be quite a extensive collection from around the world. Or was it mostly South African?
Mostly South African.
Yeah.
Some from overseas, okay. And a couple from my family. But we're also moving next year.
Okay, way
to a security estate.
Sure, yeah.
So every morning when I get up, I look at something, I say, I've got to get rid of that. I've got a big box in my dressing room, and I said, you don't wear those shoes in the box.
Yes, I need to
but
start.
But they're nice that. Shoes.
Yes.
And I paid a lot of money for them,
yeah.
But I don't wear those sort of shoes anymore.
Yes, yeah.
You know, I don't have that sort of lifestyle anymore.
But I must say, just in terms of, I just want to do one very short, superficial thing. You are a gorgeous woman and so stylish. I guess in Afrikaans, you would say statig. So the whole first lady label, I see it, despite the, you know, wine, the cab brand.
Right.
From Warwick originally.
Okay.
And I came in and I saw, and I know, how long ago did you guys sell the farm? How long has it been now?
It'll almost four years.
I thought 4 or 5 years. But it's nice to see you guys, you still drink Warwick?
Yeah.
Mostly? I see cases.
No, not
and
mostly,
some bottles.
We drink everything.
Okay.
But I have quite a bit of Warwick. And I'm also, the problem is we don't drink very much anymore.
Okay. Yeah.
We used to. And well, I had one glass of wine last night. Richard didn't have anything.
Yes.
And it was a Warwick Chardonnay, first a White Lady, which I love. And you know, I've got a big cellar full of wine, and I said to my friend Trevor Townsend yesterday, somebody said sell it. I said I'd rather give it to my friends than sell it.
Yes.
But my friends don't drink very much either. I said, come on, you guys.
Listen, I'm not a friend, but if you need to give it away,
okay.
we still drink a lot of wine. I'm sure I'll get to the point where you start drinking,
you know,
less wine too.
It's age related because, you know, two glasses of wine, I've had enough.
Yeah.
Otherwise, I don't feel great the next day.
Yes.
Isn't that sad?
It just gets worse. I mean, I'm in my 40s and you have a couple of glasses of wine the previous night and it feels like you've had wine the next morning, which is strange. It was never that,
never
was never
was
that
like,
way in my
30s. And you used to have a bottle.
Yes, that too, which we still do. But
no, each.
Yeah, sure, sure, that too. But Norma, it's interesting. I was at La Petite Femme yesterday, and one of the ladies that's worked there for a long time said, Mark, the previous owner, he finds it very difficult. He can't even drive that road after they sold the farm.
Oh, Mark
and
Denny
it's so,
Young.
Yes, and it's he's so emotional about that history that in his life, the farm. Do you ever feel that way about Warwick?
Not really.
Okay.
I'll tell you why. Because, and nobody in my family feels like that. You know, my husband died, and then we carried out and on, and it was long before the industry hit this slump. Things were booming.
Yes.
And Mike said he wanted to, he had started a business, he'd like to do his business and his marketing business. Jenny lived in Joburg. She was in the wine industry, but she said she wasn't sure that she would actually like to run the farm. So I said, all right, I'm in my 70s. I don't want to run it on my own. I said, if I get a buyer at the right price, I'm going to sell it. And they agreed. So my family don't have that regret or remorse.
It's a lot of work and a lot of responsibility, is it?
Yeah.
And having that, over the years, that partnership with your husband that's unfortunately passed on, that makes it a dual responsibility, slightly of a lighter responsibility.
And we built that farm up together from nothing. Yes. There were no vines on it.
Yeah.
There was no winery. We had a big bond on the farm. And we said we wouldn't start making wine until
you paid off.
We paid it off. Because, I mean, it seems ridiculous the amount that the bond was then. But it was a lot.
Yes.
I mean, it was a lot. And we did a lot of cash crops and things like that. We needed cash to just operate.
Yes.
And then we'd get enough cash, we'd plant one vineyard.
Beautiful.
And so he died 17 years ago. I mean, it's hard to believe.
Yes, it's a long time ago.
Yeah, it was in the 60s.
1964 is when you guys bought the farm.
Correct.
So give me an idea of why you decided to buy a farm in that Stellenbosch, Klapmans region. And, you know, why did you decide on wine?
Okay.
I know you've got a kind of, you've got a science study background, but why
okay,
did
I didn't buy
that?
The farm. Stan bought the farm.
Sure.
I wasn't around yet.
Okay.
But he and his father had a chicken farm in Kraaifontein, and they grew broilers for County Fair. And Stan loved farming, as did his father, who was like a closet farmer, because he worked in the family business, but he wanted to really farm. And the that farm was expropriated. I've been there recently to have a look. It was expropriated for a township in Kraaifontein that's now called Sunrise. Well, Sunrise is like a huge suburb with big trees, and it's very nice. Plus the fact, you know, the soil wasn't very good there, so you couldn't really plant much. So when that farm was sold, Stan's father said, "Now, what do you want to do?" And he said, "Well, I'd like to do grape farming." So he went to Elsenburg, and he wanted to buy a farm, but obviously he couldn't. He was a young man. He was in his 20s still.
Yes.
So his dad said, "We've been paid out for the other farm. You borrow from the bank, but I will be your guarantor. I'll sign for it," which was fine. And so he said he wanted to grow grapes. And he had wonderful stories about looking for a farm. He wanted a farm that was undeveloped. And so he could, he was a young man, build it up from scratch.
He wanted to build something.
Yeah.
Affecting
and
himself.
So it eventually came down to Warwick or Rustin Frieda. And I said, "Why didn't you buy Rustin Frieda? It had that gorgeous house." He said they didn't have any water.
Oh, my word, yeah.
You know, there were things, and he said they'd already had grapes planted. I think they had Shiraz or something in those days. I don't know what it was. But he tells me he looked at farms in the Kobakkeveld and the everywhere. And he came to this one because it was, I shouldn't say it, neglected. Because the guy that owned it didn't have any money to put into the farm. He was a gentleman farmer. He didn't have income coming in from the farm. And so that's how it happened.
Yeah. So which varietals did you guys plant first? I know you are credited for Cabernet Franc, of course, also.
But that came much later.
But yeah, so give us an idea of
okay, what the first things that were planted were Cabernet and Cinsault. And I also said to Stan, "Why did you plant those varieties?" He said, "I went and had drinks with all my neighbors every night."
Yeah.
And they were old guys, Grayling Duplessis, Dilleray Duplessis, and they gave him advice. Annemie Carnets. And they said, "This is what works." And You know, don't try and reinvent the wheel, which I told my own son when he came into the business and had a lot of very good ideas. I said, go and talk to the neighbors.
Yeah.
Or anyone in the wine industry and say, okay, what's Cabernet still works in the Simonsburg area.
Yeah.
Nord, yeah. And that's how, and then we later planted Pinotage, which served us well. We only planted Cabernet Franc in 1981, after we'd been to Bordeaux.
And it was the first for South Africa,
no,
if I understand.
No, it wasn't the first. Landskroon Hensam, we planted the same time as Nirlust, because they got that clone. It was an Italian clone from northern Italy. We got it from Distel. It was Distillers Corporation then.
Yes, yeah.
And so, it wasn't the first.
Okay.
But we were the first to produce a good Cabernet Franc as a single varietal. That was 1988.
I find Cabernet Franc one of the... I love that varietal because it's such an interesting varietal. So I know there's a festival every year. It hasn't taken place now in a couple of years because of COVID. Or I would order online a variety of different Cabernet Francs to taste, and it's such an interesting varietal. So it served you well.
Yeah, I loved it right from the beginning.
Yes. Yeah.
But you know, it also, it worked well where we planted it, and you know, that's one of the big keys.
Yes.
And it wasn't because we were so clever. Mm. It was a guess, because nobody knew what they were doing with that varietal much.
Yes.
And Nico Meiberg at Mirlast gave me a lot of help, a lot of mentorship on this whole story, because they had planted it for their blend.
Yes, yeah.
For the Rubicon, I guess.
Yeah.
And he was really, really helpful. They were all helpful.
it's interesting because Beyers Trieter also said, you know, when he bought Beyers Kloof, it was the industry that assisted him, and that's the reason why he could do what he did.
Totally.
And establish. Yeah.
Totally.
That's wonderful. What are some of the challenges that you guys had? Obviously, you needed to pay off your bond before you started planting, and every time you got a cash flow, you added onto your vineyard collection. But what were some of the biggest challenges for you? And maybe, if you don't mind, give people an idea as to your responsibility and your husband's responsibility. And did you make all the decisions together in terms of the farm and the wine?
Stan made, in the beginning, before we started making wine, was, I also had two little babies. He was very much the farmer.
Okay.
Which was his love. His love was not winemaking. And I think if I hadn't have come along in 1971, we wouldn't have made wine. We only started in 84. And he was very much the farmer, the viticulturist. And the financial side, and Stan was also a bit of an entrepreneur. You know, he had a business in Klapmuts called Klapmuts Concrete, and he had a hazardous material business that he started in Belleville. He had many hats.
Yes.
And when I said, no, I think we should make wine. No, I didn't say that. My neighbors and my colleagues said, you are crazy not to be making your own wine.
I mean, that valley, if you look at the prominence of the valley and the perfect, sorry for the word now, again, terroir.
Area. That's exactly right.
Yeah.
And
don't want to be too pretentious with, you know.
No, words. But that is the proper
terminology.
Word. And so I got interested in that side. They said, you've got the brilliant terroir. And I said, but I don't really know how to make wine. The other issue that we had going on in those days, were the restrictions in the industry with the KWV and the restrictions with pricing. So we delivered grapes to, we had to deliver grapes to someone. We needed the money.
Yes.
We couldn't make wine. And it got to the point where they were paying us so little that we said, really? This isn't covering our costs now. This is not good. So we actually said, I think we must do something else. And we did. And I said, okay, I'll take this on. And we also went to Distillers Corporation. We didn't want to lose the contract. And I said, oh, I'm just going to make a little bit of wine on the side.
Yes.
Which turned out to be a big lot of wine eventually. And yes, the first year was very successful. And
was then, Cab also the first?
Yeah.
Okay.
That was 84.
All right.
And it was a brilliant vintage to start on, which was encouraging.
Isn't it the same year that Jan Boerland's Cab, I think, won? He won Winemaker of the Year internationally. I think that Cab
could have been
84, 85. I think it was 84. But yeah,
because I'm just trying to think.
That's how I
when
remember.
Bayers came. About he yes. came about 84.
Yeah, yeah.
Or 85 maybe. That probably yeah. is true. It was a brilliant vintage.
I think it's the one where he pulled out the Shiraz and planted Cab, and then. But that's a different story.
Yeah, but that was okay. That was
so it was a good year for you guys.
Yeah,
as well.
It was. Yeah. So that was encouraging, but all during the 70s when I was. Well, I used to do pottery as well.
Okay.
During the 70s, because it suited my lifestyle. I had two little kids and lived on a farm. And so that's how I got to know most of the women in the neighborhood. They came to me for pottery lessons. It was wonderful.
So put it together for us. You are now, I know you studied BSc. So
yeah, but I did textile chemistry.
Oh, right. So that would not assist.
No,
course.
Chemistry is chemistry.
But chemistry is chemistry. So how did you decide now to make a little bit of your own wine? Obviously, you had learned now over the years quite a lot.
Yeah,
it's
yeah,
at that
but,
point been 20 years
I,
since the
but
book.
But I also I studied. Yeah. I got yes. all those wine books, the Amarim and okay. all the people in America. We didn't go on yeah. the internet.
So you
we ordered the books from America.
Yes. Oh, wow. Okay.
That's how you did it.
Yes. Yeah.
And I just read the books and I used them as reference books. When I had a problem, I'd look up and say, oh dear, this is a lot worse than I thought. But I also consulted the labs.
Okay.
I consulted my neighbors and I say, I've got a problem. What do I do? And they say, oh no, we can fix this.
Yes.
Oh, this is how you do it. But so I studied and I went to the Cape Wine Academy in the 70s. We did that with my husband, Harvey Illing from 8Cake, and who also helped me a lot. And we did the, I never did a Cape Wine Masters or anything like that, but
yeah.
We learned a lot.
Yes.
And we had a little group and we'd buy wines and taste them and well, yeah, we so told us
it's all on experience, based on experience and learning as yeah. far as you possibly can.
Yeah,
yeah.
And any seminar, I used to go to Elsenburg quite a lot. They were really people that were so happy to help. Everybody was helpful.
Yes, everybody. I think in that era were so many things that counted against the South African wine industry. If you think about the price, for example, that you guys were paid, exporting the amount of money South African wineries asked for wine overseas, which created a specific image about South Africa as well. So at what point do you think did that turn where you're, and you said you started to make a little bit of wine on the side. So at what point did it become more official for Warwick?
The next year.
So
but the
quick,
next
quick
year
success.
Wasn't the next year wasn't as good a vintage. That was 85. But it's okay. That's the one we actually launched properly.
Yes.
Because the first one, 84, I hadn't learned how to get the paperwork right for the Wine and Spirit Board, and they wouldn't certify it. So I put a gorgeous sort of Cezanne style label on it and just sold it out of hand.
Yes.
I don't know if they knew or not, but we needed money.
Yes.
And
yeah.
I said, no, we're selling this. And the 85 we launched. Very first wine that we made on the farm, 1974, which was a good vintage, we decided that we really liked the Rustenburg. And so we copied it. We took Cinsault and Cab, okay. crushed them together and made, I've still got one bottle left, and said, let's start with that.
Wow.
And you know, it's people say, how do you copy a wine? Well, I've done it since too.
Yes, yeah.
I also did it later on. Yeah. I said, but this wine is fantastic. Let's try and do this style because everybody's crazy about it.
Yes.
And so I studied during the 70s.
Okay. And at some point, so you say Stan, for example, was more the wine maker.
No, he was a viticulturist.
Yes, viticulturist. So he was in the vineyards. You focused on the wine itself.
Yeah.
Okay. The wine maker
totally.
Itself. Okay. So the balance there, was it always, you know, fairly harmonious and easy in terms of, you know, you always...
No. Sometimes it was quite fiery.
Oh, right.
And sometimes it was very fiery. For instance, even in 84... when I said, okay, we've been to Bordeaux, we know how this works. We've looked at what Nico Meiberg's doing and his success. We've looked at Billy Hofmeyr. We need new French wood. So I went off to Demtos and bought 6 new barrels. They were 184 rand, and he got he said, you know, you're gonna bankrupt me. He said, this is crazy. It was a lot of money.
Yes.
I said, well, I don't think we can do this project without...
If you don't invest.
Invest.
Probably, yeah.
But eventually, when we had successes, I think he was more relaxed about it.
Saw a future.
Saw a future. And we did have... The other thing we argued about sometimes is what we were going to plant where.
Okay.
And one particular example, there were this beautiful vineyard, Block 10, and some consultant said, oh, you must put Sauvignon Blanc in here. I said, no, you must put more Cabernet in. And I just said, I said, this is a beautiful Cabernet vineyard, because now I was involved in the vineyards. And I won.
You won.
I won. But we eventually did plant Sauvignon Blanc somewhere else, which was a brilliant success for us.
Yes.
At that stage, I said, we're a red wine farm. And I'm the one, because I was also doing the marketing and the selling. I said, I don't want to start marketing Sauvignon Blanc. This is a whole new game. I want to stick to red wine. But eventually we planted Sauvignon Blanc.
And just around the corner from Le Bonnier, that also makes a gorgeous Sauvignon.
He taught me.
Oh, right.
Mike Woodhead.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yes.
He taught me.
What a gorgeous farm as well.
Yeah, yeah, and he was a gorgeous and eccentric man. And once again, there were always... I can't remember anyone that said, I won't help you.
Yes.
I don't think it's like that still.
Yeah.
I think it's still people are...
Want to assist each other, yeah.
Yes.
Because you want the industry as a whole to be a success. Because let me then ask that question now, because I ask this question of everyone to answer. Does the industry need more, before we continue with the success in Warwick, does the industry need more cohesion, or are there cohesion within areas, winemaking areas, but not between the different areas? What do you think is needed?
I think there is cohesion, but you know, you run out of time. And we knew everyone in our area because of proximity and accessibility, and we could get together and have a meeting and saying, all of us getting together and saying, we've got to do something because these prices we're getting from the wholesalers are ridiculous.
Yes.
But we didn't include Robertson or... Maybe a bit of Paul.
Close enough.
Because we were all too busy.
Yes, yeah.
To do that. And I think there is still huge cohesion in the industry. Our one problem is, I think, the marketing cohesion overseas. And now COVID's sort of killed what was going.
Yes.
It'll come back. And our budgets are small. Wines of South Africa haven't got much budget.
Yes.
Although, while I've just come back from Canada, as you know, where my daughter lives, and we were invited by the Woza people to a tasting of Cabernet, Chenin Blanc, and MCC, which was really an eye-opener for me, because they were all fabulous wines. But I was sitting across from two people from the Ontario Liquor Board. And I said, why haven't you listed these wines? They said they're fabulous, but nobody knows about them.
Yeah.
They do list some good ones, but our representation there is poor. And they are also in business. They want to buy stuff that's going to sell.
Be commercially viable, yeah.
Yes, of course. And we had Peter Ferreira, Christo, Lirish, and Ken Forrester being interviewed, and they're very good. And that was broadcast to wine tastings in almost all the main centers.
Wonderful.
Where they had the wines in front of them, as we did.
Yeah.
We were also given a fabulous meal, which was a bonus. And we heard what these guys had to say. Once again, it was too long. People were looking at their watches and saying, you know, I've got, they're journalists and wine buyers. I've got another appointment. It was like 2.5 hours. Really? Uh-uh. Even I, whom retired, said,
Too long.
This is too long.
Yeah.
And you lose focus.
Yeah. And on the note of, we're going to come back to what you would see as your biggest successes and the farm Warwick's biggest successes over the years. But while we're in Canada now, I want to go all the way back to your years growing up in Canada and how you ended up in South Africa. Would you like to share that history with us? Because I don't know if a lot of people know exactly how you ended up in South Africa.
Well, I grew up in northern Canada, very cold, so we all did winter sports, big time.
Yes.
And I went to school and I went to university at the University of Alberta.
Textile BSc, you say?
Yeah.
Is that what you studied? May I just quickly ask, why did you decide on BSc textile?
You know what? I did it because I was good at chemistry.
Okay.
Why do we make these decisions? I don't know sometimes. because, you know, half the people that I graduated with never ended up doing what they were trained for.
Yes.
But the brain was trained.
Yes.
And then those were the golden years in all over the world, really, not just in Canada. When we graduated from university, businesses were queuing up to hire us. They, like, 5 nice job offers, and I had a job offer in Montreal. I thought, this sounds pretty exciting. Okay. And I went to Montreal and worked for a big textile company. But soon realized that's not really what I wanted to do. I worked in the promotions department,
okay,
which I loved. And I had itchy feet.
You wanted to travel.
I wanted to travel. So I went to Europe. And I was a qualified ski instructor. So I went for the winter and I got a job in a ski resort in Switzerland. You know, you just think how naive one is at that stage in your life, because I never thought about how I was going to live or where I was going to get money. Although I had already worked, I didn't go straight after university. And I spent the winter in a ski resort. Yeah, which was great.
What is your favorite sport? Because I know you're a keen golfer as well, but focusing on the winter sports.
Well, skiing.
Skiing, yeah.
I did all the winter sports. But skiing I was good at. And I did skating and figure skating. Curling.
Curling?
Yeah.
What is curling?
Curling, it's an Olympic sport where you... It's like bowls.
Oh, right.
When you throw a big, heavy stone down the ice and knock the other. It's like bowls.
Oh, right.
It's like bowls.
Yeah, okay. All right.
Anyway, so No, I love golf, but I'm getting worse by the day, I have to tell you.
But you say you stay quite fit, so do you guys?
Yeah, but
just
I walk
walking?
A lot.
Okay.
Walk right. a lot, and yes. I still work out.
Yes, well, you can see that. Well done.
Yeah, but but some days I don't feel like
it. You don't feel like it, which is your right.
But I try and do it. I try and do it. And when I was in Canada, my daughter had a COVID boot camp in her driveway, and the first day I went to that. Well, I came in and went straight to bed. I was so finished. And so I went to the instructor and I said, no, I'm not coming back. He said, no, bring lighter weights.
Yes.
Yeah. Bring your own weights and just do what you can.
Yeah.
Don't try and keep up.
Yes.
They were all young women in their 40s.
There's a little bit of competitiveness always in one's life.
Yeah, I know. Anyway, so that was fun. And I met all the neighborhood women.
Wonderful.
Which was fun. And anyway, so then...
From the ski resort.
I went to Greece, where I worked. And that's where I met my husband.
How did you guys meet?
We met sailing. I'll tell you how we actually met. My girlfriend and I ran a restaurant about 3 or 4 kilometers out from... We were in Mykonos.
Okay.
And we worked out that we didn't have to work every day. We could work alternate days and make enough money to... go on.
Live, yeah.
It was cheap in Europe in those days. And so one day she went, and then I got another job on the alternate day working as a disc jockey in a discotheque to make more money. You know, all those things.
You have done everything.
You're I know, it was crazy.
DJ, yeah, okay.
And I actually got fired from that job, actually, because... one, it was still a thing when you picked up the needle and you put it on the record. I mean, that's how ancient it was ago. That was like 50-something years ago. And I think I'd had too many glasses of wine. Mm. And I dropped the needle on some record and completely destroyed it. So his name was Billy. He said, right, don't come back.
I have respect for the vinyl.
he said, don't come back.
Shame.
And my girlfriend... met these South Africans that were sailing in, and they used to come in for lunch. And she said, oh, and why don't you join us and we'll all go out on a dinner together. And one of them was my future husband.
Oh, wonderful.
Yeah.
And the rest is history.
Yeah.
How long did you date before you ended up coming to South Africa?
Not long.
Yeah, quick.
I didn't want to tell my dad I was coming to South Africa because... you know, he was so anti.
Yeah.
So I told him I was going to Ghana.
Okay.
To visit some of his friends that were in the diplomatic service. Her name was Norma. Norma and Jack Watts. But he wasn't stupid. He worked out. He said, I know there's a man involved here. And then he said, you know what you're doing. Then I said, I'm going to South Africa. He said, you know, this is a police state, and I got the big lecture. I said, no, well, I'm going.
Yes.
And then we went back to Canada and were married there, as we did in our mother's church. You know, that's how we did
beautiful.
It then.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the enormous success with this, the story is just amazing to me. You know, the way that people built something on a very small scale in the beginning, and just you worked very, very hard at creating something, your own legacy. And as you said, that's what your husband Stan wanted, is to build something from the ground up for himself and leave that legacy, which you fulfilled then from the winemaking side, of course. And I mean, the amount of awards, and obviously the 1659 Medal of Honor that you received, top honors in South Africa when it comes to winemaking. I want to talk about the fact that you played such an important role for women also in the wine industry. I mean, I remember a time 15 years ago, if there was a female winemaker, we'd jump at doing an interview because it was rare still at a stage, more maybe 20 years ago. But from your perspective, and I know people try and be humble and everything, but what are you the proudest of in terms of the success? Obviously, your beautiful kids.
who are both still in the wine business.
In terms of the industry, how would you?
Well, I think the one thing is that I was a woman in the wine industry, and everyone says, "Didn't you have pushback? Weren't these guys resistant?" And I said, "No, They weren't.
Yeah.
But then I was a bit of a novelty. And in, I remember Kevin Arnold saying, he was at Delheim. He said, you know what, if you're going to make wine, we're going to help you make the best wine you can make because we don't want bad wine in this valley. That nice. That's was their yeah. approach. And
The pride of place.
And in terms of doing things for the women in the industry, okay, I think I plowed a lot of rows for sure. But that was not what I set out to do.
Sure.
I was doing it for myself. I mean, I have to be honest. This was totally selfish, and it was exciting. And the fact that I took a lot of women along with me
yes.
was a big bonus. And then when we started the Women in Wine Exchange, which was only about 10 years ago, I think this was quite... was and is still quite a cohesive element. And you know, we've got a Facebook thing and everything else about women asking other women, what do I do now?
Yes.
Where do I get this?
Mentoring each other maybe.
Yeah, bit, yeah. And who's going to help me get a job for a vintage in California? Mm. And this is before COVID, we used to meet physically. And they weren't all technical tastings. Some of them were just parties, networking.
Yeah.
And we started being winemakers, and then the marketing girls came and the journalists came. They said, can't we join? Sure, why not?
Wonderful.
And Karina DeToy was very instrumental in getting it going and keeping it going. And so... But that's quite recent. But I think I did quite a bit of mentoring. They'd come to me and say, how are we going to do this?
Yes.
And when I first started marketing wine, which was in Johannesburg, where I knew I had to get out there. And it was Michael Fridgen's business called, it was then called Constantia Negotiants, and he had a brilliant rep called Terry Helps, who took me everywhere. And she said, well, I don't know quite how to treat you. And I said, what do you mean? She said, I've only had men, big burly men come. Yeah. And I said, well, I don't know, treat me the same.
Yeah.
Do what you would do with them. And she also became a very good friend.
Interesting.
And the one of the other things that I was very proud of, which nobody knows much about, you know, things really took off when Mandela was released from jail, not in 94, in February 11th, 1990. Suddenly we were the dream child of wine, and they came from everywhere and they wanted to sell our wine.
And the markets opened.
That was good for us.
Yes.
And we started immediately with various agents. The first agent was one from Germany, who we still have, and they still have.
Wonderful.
Who also taught us a lot.
Terms of marketing?
Yeah.
Okay.
In terms of marketing and what the market wants and how they want it. And then... in 1994, but I really got out there then. I just saw this export opportunity as something that was just going
to
take our business
to the next
level.
Yeah.
And it did.
Yes.
And it totally did, so that we actually didn't have enough wine.
Yeah.
We had to like pep this up. We still sold some grapes in those days.
Yes.
Even in 1990. Mm. Cash flow.
Yes.
So we said, no, we're going to make all this wine ourselves. And then in 1994, they had the President Mandela Awards for Export Excellence.
Yes.
And we were selected as the small... They had, you know, a big co-op, and they had, you know, various size businesses. It wasn't just wine. And so we got the sort of small... Small cap,
yes,
award, and that was one of my biggest thrills.
Yeah, 95 Exporter of the Year, as I remember.
Yeah, it was 95.
Yes, yeah.
And that was a big thrill because I'd put a lot of energy into that.
Yes, yeah. Do you think winemakers underrate how important it is to get out there? And it's a horrible way to put it, to say go peddle your product. I mean, it's a bit of a demeaning word. But yeah,
it's
you are
not
selling a product. Yeah.
And I think the people that still have this pie in the sky attitude that they're going to make beautiful wine, and people come to me and ask advice, and I said, this wine's beautiful, now how are you going to sell it?
Exactly, yeah.
Because you've got to sell this before you can make more. You don't have space, etc., etc. And they say, well, no, I'm an artist. Well, I said, you're not going to make it.
Yeah.
Then hire somebody to do it for you.
Exactly, yeah.
But most new winemakers can't afford to hire someone to do it.
And they're uncomfortable with the idea of selling themselves.
Yeah, well, yeah. Get over
it. You've got to get over it. But just the last note on the women in wine aspect, because that is not your legacy. I mean, it's so much more than that. It's just a big part of how important you have been in the wine industry in South Africa. First women to be part of the Cape Winemakers Guild, and it is still today a discussion that, you know, more women should become members. You've got Andrea Milineau, for example, now. I think she's the chairperson last year or in this last couple of years. But it still remains a discussion.
It remains an old boys club.
Sure.
We love the old boys, but now it's not. I mean, old boys in a different term, because most of the guys that we started with in the guild have retired or resigned.
Yeah.
Some of them to make a place for their sons, because you're not allowed to have two people in the same family in the guild or something like that.
Sure.
And so they're in their 70s. Bram van Velden, Etienne Lariche, Neil Ellis, Jeff Greer, I see, has just resigned. He's quite a bit younger than me. But it's giving way to the new people.
Yeah.
But they're young boys, but it's still an old boys club.
Yeah.
But the girls, the women that they've got in the guild are powerful women. They're going to make things happen.
Yes.
They're all powerful.
Yeah.
Personalities, wines, marketing, everything.
Wonderful.
So, I mean, I'm so proud of them. In fact, Andrea Milineau and Chris are having a wine dinner here in Constantia at the end of this month. And I'm definitely going to be there as a supporter.
Wonderful.
And taking friends. And they said, oh, we don't really know them. I said, well, you should.
Yeah, that's should know the wines.
Yeah.
It's gorgeous wines. Yeah. But in terms of the Cape blend as well, I referred to Cab Franc because I read that you were the first person to develop Cab Franc. You've now said that fact is incorrect.
Yeah.
Is it the same with the Cape blend? You developed also the first Cape blend, I read. So I'm not sure you're going to have to...
Well, no, I didn't do the first Cape blend.
So then it's online is wrong.
Okay, actually, I did a Cape blend in about 1991 or 2 that was Pinotage and Merlot.
Yes, yeah.
But we didn't call it a Cape blend.
Yes.
It was just a blend.
It's now technically probably
now technically more. It's a
How much
Cape
Pinotage was in that blend?
Oh, a lot.
Yeah. Because it's supposed to be 30%, but I heard now recently 15% Pinotage is enough to be called a Cape blend. But I'm speaking under correction.
I don't even know if you have to have Pinotage in it.
Yeah, okay.
And then in 1994, we went, a whole group of us, because it was now open.
Yes.
And we went to the Vancouver Wine Show, and we went right across Canada, and we were marketing Pinotage.
Yeah.
And everybody was so interested, but I put in a Pinotage. I still had some of this left, so I generously put it in to show what it can be as a blend, not just Pinotage.
Yes.
Because when I came back from that trip, I said, you know what? There's two things we've got to do. We've got to start selling wine in a hard currency. And the other thing is, we're going to put a Pinotage blend on the market, because Pinotage at the moment is a bit too Pinotage-y for them
okay.
in North America, because they don't you know, they don't really understand it yet.
Are they looking for the, because you get Pinotages, with Pinot Noir, same thing. You get the Opiberg, which is a heavier Pinot Noir from the Grindel, and then you get your more classical French lighter style Pinot Noir. Apologies for the boring description, lighter style. But you get the same with Pinotage, for example.
Totally.
That you, what
there
do they
are
prefer?
So many different styles.
What do they prefer in that massive American market? You said now, for example, it's too Pinotage for them. So
I don't
what do you
know.
Think?
Now that they're used to it, and they also see that something like Beers Kloof and Canon Corp can age, that's
very
popular.
Well, yeah.
But we made a fresh style of Pinotage until I came back and I said, we're going to make a Pinotage blend. So it was Pinotage, Cab, and Merlot, because it was something they would recognize, like a Bordeaux blend, but it had Pinotage in.
Yes.
Three Cape Ladies took off.
Wow, yes.
And I did enter it. It was the 97 vintage. I did enter it in the competition that came up. I think it was Diners Club or something. And I didn't win. And I was so disappointed because, I mean, I really thought it was so stunning.
Yeah.
But they had overseas judges, and at that stage, they didn't have... you didn't have to have Pinotage in a Cape blend. And Renelle Veet, she won it. And hers was a Shiraz blend. I see when I cleaned out my cellar, I've still got one bottle of that. It was Cab, Shiraz, and something else. She won, which I was very happy about, but I still thought, I really love this wine.
You were proud of it.
I was proud of it.
Yeah.
And it had a gorgeous label, which also sold it. Mm. With the three there. Oh no, it's not here. I'll show you later.
Is the one? No, it's not the one behind you. No.
With the three Cape Ladies holding.
I think it's the one behind you.
That's one there.
Oh right, because one there's one there.
My granddaughter did that for my 70th birthday.
Gorgeous.
And so then that took off.
Yeah.
The three Cape Ladies.
In terms of just a quick question, in terms of the name Warwick and then the varietals, First Lady, Three Cape Ladies. How did you decide on, was the farm called Warwick when Stan bought it originally?
Yes.
Okay, so you decided to keep the name. You know what the history of
that
name is?
They said it's very bad luck to
change the name. Okay, all right.
But it was a nice name.
Yeah, it is. Do you know what the history is of Warwick?
Totally. And that's what I'm going to write about in my little book.
Yes.
Colonel Gordon came out for the Boer War, and his regiment was the Warwickshire
Regiment.
His brother was also the colonel of the of the Highlanders.
Oh wow.
But they both stayed in South Africa. Okay. He bought Warwick.
Right.
Much later, after the war.
Yeah.
In the 20s.
And First Lady and Cape
and
Lady.
He called that farm, was part of a huge farm in that valley called De Goede Success.
Okay.
But he called it Warwick.
Beautiful.
So when we got going, we also thought it would be quite useful to have this English name. But of course, nobody in South Africa can pronounce it.
Yeah, I remember when I was younger, my father had to correct me because we were driving past the farm. I think I was 18 or something, and I pronounced it incorrectly, said no, it's Warwick, you know.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Well, it was also confusing because of Dionne Warwick.
Yes, yeah, Warwick.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And
yeah.
Anyway, so that was good. And in terms of when we started with our labeling and everything in 1994, a friend of mine, dear friend, who's still a dear friend, did our labels, and we collaborated, and she said, no, you must have something female about this.
Okay.
Because now you're starting this new brand, and I didn't bring it out, the marriage cup, which we used as a logo on all the labels.
Yes.
And then we used the lady name, the Three Cape Ladies.
Beautiful.
But the First Lady brand, which was our second tier brand, my kids called First Lady.
Okay. I've had so many bottles of that wine. in my life, I must say.
Well, you can see one standing there that Richard's working on.
Because I came in through the garage, I saw the Warwick boxes, and I thought that's quite sweet, you know.
Yeah.
In terms of the future of the wine industry, we did touch on a little bit earlier when we spoke about cohesion and working together. What do you think what would your best advice be to a winemaker today in South Africa and for the industry in the future? What do we need to do, I'm not a winemaker. What do they need to do better or differently?
Well, I think one of the big changes in the industry in my time that is significant is not winemaking, viticulture.
Yes.
The varieties we're planting, the places we're planting them, whole new areas have opened up. The old vine revival is unbelievable. I've got a bottle of that standing ready to drink too, some old Cinsault.
Gorgeous.
And I think that people have to move with that. A lot of the young guys have been very successful, and I cheer them on. They can't afford to buy vineyards anymore. It's too expensive. Mm-hmm. They're buying in from interesting areas and perfecting that style they bought from Darling and Elgin and...
Like what Neil Ellis started many
years
ago. Yes.
I mean, he was way ahead of his time.
Yeah.
And I think that is a trend because people are making great wines. You know, I still go to the Cape Wine. I haven't much in COVID, the Cape Winemakers Guild. I still go to their technical tastings because I learn so much. I don't even recognize some of these guys. Who's he? Although they send me all this stuff by email, I think. Yeah. And then they give a tasting and I hear what they're doing. It's really exciting.
Yeah.
However, these lovely winemakers, some of them are making too little wine to make any impact in the market anywhere.
Yes.
You know, where if they've got a small importer in Europe, it's okay, but if they want to get a listing somewhere, they've got to be able to supply on a routine basis. And the day you don't supply your restaurant, they just take you off the list and say goodbye.
Ooh. Bless you.
Shh.
Oh, he's so nice. It's Richard.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah. And I think if people could be more aware of the exciting wines that are being made here. But I think the future of the wine industry is the middle size Beerskloof, the Warwick, the Delheim, Rustenfrieda are the people that can produce the volume to make a statement.
Yes, yeah, I understand. That are able to, as you said, sustain that supply.
Yeah, sustain the supply.
Because consistency is a big thing for the consumer. If you go to a shop, you need to be able to, or a restaurant, you want to eat the same dish, for example, and the same consistency steak and wine list. It's okay, don't worry. No, it's a house, people are... We are very relaxed.
Does he know what you're doing?
It's okay.
Anyway, so yeah, I think the sustainability. And another one is Giles Webb.
Yes.
I mean, they started the same year we did, but it's consistent. It's good, and he does a big enough volume to make impact somewhere.
Yes. And then lastly, this is Wineland Media supports this podcast series, and they're 90 years old this year. Do you have a message for them? Birthday message? Possibly.
Wow.
The old Wynboer, just let's say. But yeah, they've turned 90 a couple of weeks ago, I think, yeah.
Well, I think that, you know, it's not that long ago.
Yeah,
and
true.
It's very exciting. You know what? There's some big boots there that prepared the way for us. And I congratulate them and thank them for what they did for all of us. Okay. 90 years isn't that long.
Yeah, actually not.
And they laid the groundwork for what we did later.
Yes.
And we hope we laid the groundwork for what they're going to do later on too.
But is there anything that you, apologies, that is a, that I read up obviously, and they said you did the first cab and you did the first, and now it's incorrect. Apologies for that. But
that's okay.
But is there anything that you think is important you'd like to add?
Oh yeah, you did one question I didn't finish answering. Yes. Was that when they gave me the 1659 medal?
Yes.
That was one of my highlights. Because it's not for a winemaker. It's for your what you've contributed to the industry generally that has left a legacy. Yeah. And that that really made me feel good.
Yeah.
Not just making good wine. That's not, doesn't come into it. It's what did you do?
Yeah.
And Dame P was before me, and you know, he was a great supporter, but look at the legacy he left.
Yes.
And Dave Hughes, Jan Borland.
Yeah.
He got it. Charles Back.
Yes.
It's not about the wine they made, it's about what they did.
Yes. In samewerking met Wineland Media, deel van die Winpro familie wat hierdie jaar ook hulle 90ste verjaarsdag vier.